from stpetecatalyst.com.
Hello again, it's the Catalyst Sessions. I'm Bill DeYoung. This is our 75th program today. We started this at the end of March to kind of bring the Tampa Bay area's arts community together, not knowing how long it would be until we could all be in the same room. We're still not all in the same room, but I think in a sort of figurative way, we are. 75 times going a little bit out of our regular sphere today to talk to a great artist and songwriter, and I'm happy to say a friend of mine, Mr. Rodney Crowell from the great state of Tennessee. Hello, sir.
Hello, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing great today. I need a little more coffee, but other than that, I'm surviving, man. So it's good. It's good to see you. I got a whole lot of questions here, and the introduction basically goes, folks, if you don't know who this is, he's won a couple of Grammys. He's in the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame. He's written so many great songs that you know, all the usual suspects. And if you're watching this, you know all that stuff. You know all the titles. He is also a recording artist of some incredible renown. And, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's Rodney. Come on. So listen, I wanted to ask you to address the gorilla in the room, which is COVID.
COVID.
But what has isolation given you the opportunity to do that maybe you haven't done? How's your life right now?
Well, my life is good because I have 5 acres on a hilltop in Tennessee, you know, a half hour from downtown. And I have about 6 miles of hiking, you know, undisturbed. You know, I meet a few people along the way on the hiking trails. So we're on top of a hill, Claudia and I, and, you know, hey, I'm a songwriter, you know. So, you know, if I'm not on the road in life before COVID, I definitely was sheltered in place. You know, the singular existence, you being a writer, you know all about the singular existence. Mm-hmm. I'm really comfortable in that real singularity, you know, get up in the morning and have a cup of coffee and start working, you know, writing.
How is this, I don't know if affected the right word, but yeah, how has it affected, you know, your writing? I mean, are you writing, you know, differently or more prolifically, I guess, during this period?
Oh, I don't know. I've done this. I've written so long and, you know, over the course of the career that I've had, you know, I've certainly painted myself into the corner. You know, not to compare myself to Leonard Cohen, but to compare my experience of the process with some things I read from him.
Yeah.
You know, he said, man, I'm going to quit because this just gets harder and harder and harder. And it does, you know. I'm not at liberty to, you know, to be 24 years old anymore and just believe everything that comes to me is the living end. It's long ago was proven not to be. So there's a lot more work involved in it. But the good news is I love the work and I embrace the work. So, you know, it's taken me, you know, there are a few songs in my catalog that, you know, one of them took 30 years to write, a couple of 25-year investments in getting a song.
Yeah.
So, not sure I'm answering your question. So the isolation, you know.
Well, I mean, do you sort of say, you know, I'm in isolation. Does that imbue what you're writing about? Well, I'm not on the road. I can't pretty much see my friends, you know. Yeah. A little sad, I suppose.
I'm not sad. I'm angry.
Yeah.
I'm angry. You know, I, common sense told me a while back that we were trying to reopen this country too soon. And I'm angry because had we paid attention to science, we would be our experience would be more like what's going on in Europe and other parts of the world. We could, you know, yeah. We're going to have to go back and go through this. You know, maybe we just have to accept that as a nation, we have to learn our lessons the hard way. It kind of makes me angry because it doesn't have to be that way. Yet it is.
I was thinking about a song of yours this morning called Ignorance is the Enemy. And I played it on the car coming in here, this morning, which is, I think if you've ever written something for all time, that may well have been it. But I wanted to address the fact that you had John Prine on there, who was a pal of yours. And I don't know, we lost John from this thing. I mean, what are you thinking? Your memories of him and it didn't need to be, I guess. You know, he could still be here with us.
Yeah, I suppose. Yes, I suppose. But I think John and Fiona is John's wife, I think they were unlucky in that they were traveling somewhere before word got around that there was this virus out there. Mm-hmm. I think this to be true because it was early on in the process that we got news that Fiona was positive. And you know what? And my daughter, my next youngest daughter, Chelsea, she had it in late January. Mm. So it was around. And sadly, I think in John's case, because John, you know, he dealt with some health issues from some cancer that he had to fight along the way.
Yes.
And I think if it hadn't, you know, caught him off guard, we might not have lost him, you know. And yeah, it's a sad thing. John was a very kind-hearted fellow, really funny, as we all know, and brilliant, and just a sweet, you know, he's a Buddha. John was a Buddha. He was his own self-made Buddha. And I always had this, you know, around John, it's like being around a campfire. You just want to hold your hands out, you know, and be warmed by his presence. You know, when him leaving the planet, it's like there's a cold wind blowing where John used to create warmth.
Wow. I never had the pleasure of meeting him, but, you know, he and Fiona had a house here in Gulfport, which is right outside where we are right now, St. Petersburg. And so I had a lot of mutual friends, and I never had the pleasure of meeting either of them, but that's just how it worked. Is songwriting therapy for you? I mean, and I want to put a caveat with that, because so much of what you write clearly comes from in here, but I'm thinking about like the Texas record. You can write this Roadhouse stuff and more universal tunes too. I was going to say, how do you approach it? And if you say, turn left at Greenland or whatever, we're turning this off. But you know what I mean? Is it therapy for you, Rod?
I suppose it can be. No, it's in the Scene Gospels, there's this line in a poem that says, the man who has found his work needs ask for no other blessing. Mm. And I found my work early. And it's proven to be that I did find my work, and it just so happens that the work that I was qualified for allows me a lot of free time and allows me to live in my imagination a lot. And over time, you know, as you know, you knew Guy Clark, and as you know, my relationship with Guy was, he helped me learn how to ground my imagination, you know, to take the dream world and through the process of work to ground it so that you could be productive with it. So I don't think it's therapy. Honestly, I understand the question could be that way, but I think it's more of a blessing. Therapy, you know, for me requires work. And songwriting is work. But it's work dropped on you from on high. Whereas, you know, therapy, you got to you gotta get in there. You gotta hire somebody and pay $150 an hour, which I've done.
Yeah, well, me too. You know,
whether that it was money well, it seems to be money well spent. You know,
that's interesting what you said about Guy, because that was something I always admired about him, was that whatever he was writing about was always rooted in him. Sometimes it was just his sense of humor, but I could always tell if I heard something that came from him, you know. And I wanted to talk to you about obviously about the Close Ties record, and I think at one point you said the song called It Ain't Over Yet, famously, was about Susanna and Guy. And can you talk about that a little bit?
And myself.
Yeah.
It's a three-way conversation, really, the song. With some liberties, thinking, you know, Guy at the end of his life. I mean, it really started, you know, I started with Guy, you know, at the end of his life, you know, with these little wobbly legs and watery eyes imagery. And myself, you know, in the middle part of, in my more arrogant years, my more ego-driven years, when close friends like that had to tolerate me to some extent, you know, and you know, willingly stick a pin in my balloon and bust my ego bubble. And then, of course, there's, you know, the bridge part that Roseanne takes on that, you know, silly boys blind to make their mark. You know, she always teased, you know, myself and Guy and anybody, Steve Rohl, you know, Towns, she always said that you boys are just so competitive, you know, and true, you know, and it's like she created with no sense of competition, you know, unless, you know, if I think that through a little bit more, her work as an artist, she was competitive, but it was that her emotional intelligence far exceeded the boys that she hung around. And she said, you know, stick around, boys, I'll teach you something. And she certainly taught me a lot.
What was the process like for you to for yourself to stick the pin in that bubble? I mean, you know, when you were in your 20s, mid late 20s, early 30s, to hear you describe yourself as arrogant, you were very productive, obviously, but these were, of course, different days and substances and all the shit that was going on in those days. But how did you finally get outside your own ego and get outside yourself and say, this is what I do, and I'm
you're assuming that I have.
Assuming that you have, exactly.
maybe the honest look at that would be that on occasion, maybe, you know, I'm out of, you know, my ego-driven desires.
Was that the time, what, you know, Houston Kid time? There's this seismic shift in the way you wrote, the way you recorded, the way you presented as an artist. Was that the time? What happened?
Well, that would be a time when I failed. I made a couple of records for MCA where they gave me a lot of money, and so I thought it was my job to chase commerciality. Mm. And this was after the big, you know, five number ones off of Diamonds and Dirt. And so I tried to chase that, you know, from an intellectual point of view, I guess you would say, or a fear-based, ego-driven point of view, that, okay, they're giving me a lot of money. I got to reclaim that moment. And when I just made some music that clicked, and I failed at it fairly miserably. And didn't record for 4 or 5 years. Had an interesting thing happen, though. Mm-hmm. Richard Dodd is a recording engineer, mixing engineer, mastering engineer. I made this record and I took it over to his studio, and because, you know, he had done those George Harrison records and Traveling Wilburys, and knew a thing or two about Sonics. You know,
I guess so.
I took it over and we listened to it. And Richard, you know, being an Englishman, you know, he very politely says, "No, Rodney," he says, that's a fine piece of work. He said, now put it up on the shelf and go make a real record. I loaded up my stuff and I said, I'll find you later. And I drove home. About halfway there, it hit me. I went, oh, he is so right. This is just me work play here.
You're breaking up here on me. Shake that thing.
And started. Yeah. I just said my internet is getting funky. We're moving.
Oh,
we're
yeah.
Moving now. How's that?
Darker, like, but yeah, well, cool. It's different. So what was that record? Was that the moment where you said, I'm not chasing I'm not a greyhound chasing that thing around the track anymore. the rabbit, you know?
It's just a realization that, hey, you know, it's time for me to buckle down and try to find out who I am and try to document who I am, you know. And basically that was the dawning of my singular experience. And at the same time, I started writing the memoir, Chinaberry Sidewalk.
Yes, right.
Which day in and day out, that process just became a matter of following my singular point of view. And I think since that time, you know, is basically, I've pretty much followed a singular point of view, I think. Certainly the broad stroke love song interests me less than, you know, that really singular thing of mainly aging and trying to access more grace and more spiritual balance to move on through this life, that, you know, whatever's left of it that I have to experience. And I think that in itself becomes a more singular experience. You follow me?
That is exactly what I'm talking about, though. That's the moment. And I wonder, but it's not to dismiss all the work that you did before that.
No, certainly not. Certainly not the songwriting.
Yeah. I mean, that begs a question too. I'm going off on a tangent here, but I mean, if you hear, say, what will the neighbors think? I mean, some good tunes on there, but do you kind of go, oh, the production or that was a Craig Leon thing? I mean, do you retain a sort of pride in everything you kind of left behind you?
I retain a lot of pride in the writing.
Yeah.
I think there's another aspect that comes into play, which is, I don't think I really found myself as a singer until I was about 49 years old. Mm. And I started to become comfortable with the sound that I was hearing. All those records I made from 1978 to 1998, mm-hmm. I just did not like the sound of that guy. I mean, it's like I would hear that guy and I said, good God almighty, Ray Charles is in the world. Who do I think I am to be making records?
Yeah.
I had to grow through that. That's a pretty harsh thing to put on oneself, but it's true. You know, that Don Everly is in the world, you know. You know, it's like you have to take a realistic look at, Or from my perspective, it's like, man, I'm writing some good songs. If I could deliver it like Ray Charles, I'd be home free.
There are still so many people, you know, in my world, let's just say, and I mean, there's millions of them around, who cherish some of those records, you know. I'm not a big fan of the Columbia hit period myself, but the Warner stuff, you know, Ain't Living Long Like This, despite the fact that it's very Brian Ahern, love you, Brian, is a great record, you know? But it's young Rod. It's very, very young, and you listen to it now. But those are great songs. Song for the Life is on there.
Mostly, yeah. I mean, well, you know, I started out with pretty good directions, and I got lost, as many people do. you know, and I think, you know, that early, you know, that record certainly, I hear it and I go, well, you know, he's okay, hang in there, pal. I like that. You know, I have some compassion for that guy. Hang on. You know, he's like, when I hear that, I think of myself as like, man, I'm chasing the fire engine and I've got a hold of it. I'm like one of those cartoon characters who's just hanging on and his feet are going straight behind him. And hang on, pal, you'll get there.
Do you ever wonder like what the trajectory of your career would have been had you had a hit in those days? You know?
Oh, I think it would have been.
You think you'd still be alive today? You know?
Yeah, I think I would have, although it could have been touch and go. It just wasn't meant to be. And, yeah. You know, I mean, even to this day, you know, I've just finished up a new record, listened to a sequence of it this morning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who knows? But, you know, I've really come to accept the fact that, you know, hey, you know, I'm a middle class artist in this world. You know, it's like, I'm, you know, Keith Richard, you know, that's, or, you know, take your pick. You know, there's a hierarchy of talent that found some way to really ring the bell consistently to get there. I've rung the bell pretty consistently over my career, but it's sort of been middle of the pack, you know? And I think probably because I have been in the middle of the pack, I personally think my work has gotten better. Mm-hmm. Because of that. The only thing I ever really have to live down or have had to live down is my own harsh judgment of what I've done. You know, there may be people out there that don't care for what I do and may have a harsh judgment that I don't know about because I don't read much in the terms of, you know, the occasional review will find me. But for the most part, I stay away from it because I subscribe to the notion that, you know, self-consciousness is the enemy of good art. You know, so I try to stay away from anything to make me self-conscious.
Man, how many people have proven that over the years? Even Paul McCartney, you know, who's the shit he's taken. But I mean, he's put out a million records, and some of them, if you were self-conscious, you'd be, oh my God, did I really do that? But it's all a body. It's all gets you here, you know. Hey, look, let's play the Barbara Walters game here in our last 5 minutes, and right. Something I never thought I'd ever ask you, but I'll do it anyway.
Okay.
Best song you ever wrote to date?
To date?
Yeah.
Well, there's a couple of good ones on this new album I have, but I would have to go with It Ain't Over Yet.
Mm. That rang the bell for you, as you said.
In terms of writing, you know, and really getting it right. Yeah.
You know, okay, best production, Sand and Water, Beth Nielsen Chapman, is such a beautiful record.
Yeah,
and as far as production, I made a list here, none of which I'm going to read because who cares. But, I mean, to your mind, where did you get as close to, you know, the artist's vision where you connected most favorably, most perfectly?
I would say the single that of 7 Year 8, Roseanne. Mm-hmm. That happened really quite naturally. And I think every step of the way, every decision that I made toward the end result was in sync with Roseanne and with the collaborators we had around. And I think the end result is a fine piece of work and interesting in that, you know, maybe with that feel of it, there was Fleetwood Mac's certain feel could have been instrumental in getting there. But in terms of just a record for itself, I think it was pretty uniquely a singular event. So from that, I think that's the best single that I produced. And I really am fond of Beth Chapman's Sand and Water.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of, I listened to that. I actually bought it recently and listened to it because I was out So I want to see what that was. And I was really pleasantly surprised. You know, 7 out of 10 is like, yeah, man, rang the bell.
Sweet record. And I need to go back and listen to it again. What about the Cicadas record? You know, that's one of those that sort of slipped by on the slipstream, you know. But I happen to like it a lot. Where do you rank that one in the pantheon?
Wow, I don't know.
You haven't even thought about it in years, right?
No, I haven't. We did that for fun.
Yeah.
I mean, that was, you know, it's like, wow, I was at a time in my career where Jim Ed Norman and Warner Brothers would spend a whole lot of money for us to just have fun. That doesn't happen anymore in the time of COVID. But literally, you know, a lot of money went into a group of musicians just having fun.
Is that the same thing with the Cherry Bombs album too? Was it? Let's do this.
You know, one of the members of the Cherry Bombs actually had a record company at the time. So he put, Tony Brown, you know, had some money.
Your piano player runs the label. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's cool. About, you know, just if you stay alive long enough, certain things can find you. You know, so there again with the same thing. I said, well, you know, that really happened because ASCAP was giving me an award, and we kind of assembled the old Cherry Bombs band and performed a couple of songs. And when it was over, you know, I said, hey, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we sound better now than we did in the 80s. Everybody agreed, so I said, well, let's record. Let's make a record.
That's
I'm not
cool.
Sure we sounded better, but...
Was Albert on that record? Was Albert Lee on that record? I can't remember.
Albert was not on the record.
Because I just saw him, you know, with Peter Asher here a little.
He should have been. Albert should have been. I think that's a mistake, a big mistake, because, you know, the Cherry Bomb started out as a little club band that we had called Rodney and Albert.
Yeah.
Out in California.
I remember that.
And Albert and I would share, you know, the vocals, singing, and we sang together. So if anybody ever says, hey, man, we don't have as much money as we used to, but we'll spend a little bit for you guys to have fun, I need to find Albert and say, okay, let's do this.
I was going
to
say, actually, right, obviously it was right before COVID, but he and Peter Asher were through here doing that two-man show they do, where they pretend to be the Everly Brothers for an hour and a half. It was really cool. Hey, speaking of Peter Asher, I think he's involved in your songwriting camp, which I wanted to touch on. We're just about out of time, but you've moved that now a whole year. Have you been doing this for a while now, whatever it's called, Adventures in Song?
Looks like I'm in a 2-year cycle on it. First one we did out in Monterey, California, the land of Steinbeck. And we had 100 people come, you know, and it was a lot of fun. It's a lot of work. Whew, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
So it was due to start in a couple of weeks, maybe like a week from now. But I had no sense that COVID was going to be out of our pockets at this time, so we pushed it to a year from now.
Yeah. Looking back on that 24, 25 year old you, the guy whose ass you wanted to kick around a little bit, could he even imagine that, you know, at you're 70 something now, 70?
I'll be 70 in August.
Okay, you're not 70 yet. Okay, sorry about that. But well, could you imagine that
I'm going to be 79?
that you'd be, you know, holding songwriting workshops and teaching young artists. You know, I mean, would he have had the patience for that?
Well, you know, as Guy Clark used to say, you can't make this shit up.
Yeah, that's very Guy. I think we are out of time, my brother, and thank you so much for helping us celebrate 75 down here in Tampa.
That's a lot, man, in a short period of time.
Yeah, we've been doing one every weekday since late March.
Man, your work ethic is not diminished at all.
Well, maybe I'll get another book someday, you know, cross my fingers. But back, if you look behind me, you remember the Phil Gernhardt and Royal Guardsmen, all that. I don't think you can see that. We did it. We put the Guardsmen back together when that book came out, and had a had a show. So that's the poster up there. That was fun. Got the band back together. My friend, thank you. And I wish you continued.
Earlier this year, I drove over the bridge.
You drove over the Skyway.
Yeah, over the Skyway. We were down there playing, and we were on our way down to get on the boat to go out. And I was telling everybody in the car, I said, God, you got to read Billy Young's book about this, what happened here in 1980.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. Well, thanks. Maybe I sold a few.
I hope so. If you out there, if you haven't read, what's the name of it? I forget the name of it.
But it's called Skyway, the True Story of Tampa Bay Signature Bridge, and you brought it down.
It's a beautiful read.
My brother, thank you for that.
Okay, buddy. Be well.
Thank you. We'll see you soon. Okay. Take care now.
From stpetecatalyst.com.